hope counsel for the next case is not offended by the lack of interest, apparently, in the audience. The next matter on for oral argument this morning is Modine versus Maribel Enterprises. As you're getting situated, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument on behalf of your clients, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel or to relator's counsel. If you'd like to use that time for rebuttal, you can raise or lower the lectern. There's a button right in front so you can match your height. I'm not making any suggestions about whether you're shorter or taller than the last litigants, but the last attorneys. Please do be mindful of the timing restrictions and state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. Counsel for relator, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Debita McGee and I represent the relator, Mr. Don Modine. This case is about whether Mr. Modine is eligible for unemployment benefits. The ULJ issued two separate decisions covering four legal issues, which together found that Mr. Modine was not eligible for unemployment benefits. I would like to focus on two of those legal issues, but first I will outline the decisions at play. In the first decision, issue number ending in 7822, the unemployment law judge found that 1. Mr. Modine quit his employment on November 13, 2017. That 2. Mr. Modine did not quit for a good reason caused by his employer. And 3. That Mr. Modine did not quit to provide necessary care for his wife, Kathy, who suffers from multiple sclerosis. This decision resulted in overpayment of $4,275. Mr. Modine asked the court to reverse this decision on any one of these three independent grounds because of errors of law and because these findings are not supported by substantial evidence. Mr. Modine also asked that the court reduce the finding of overpayment to $0. In the second decision, issue number 1782, the unemployment law judge found that after November 17, 2017, Mr. Modine was actively seeking but not available for suitable employment. Again, Mr. Modine asked the court to reverse this decision because of errors of law and because it is not supported by substantial evidence. As I mentioned before, although this case involves four legal issues, I would like to focus my argument on just two. First, whether Mr. Modine quit his employment on November 13th or whether he was discharged on November 17th. Second, whether after November 17th, Mr. Modine was available for suitable employment. Turning to the first issue, I would like to start.
Both of these questions, are they fact questions or law questions?
The first question is a factual question.
So our standard of review on a factual question is where it's clearly erroneous.
I believe it must be supported by substantial evidence in the record.
Is that the same thing as clearly erroneous in these appeals?
Yes.
Okay.
Turning back to the first issue, I want to outline the sequence of events.
What about availability? Are you making a legal argument or a factual argument to the ULJ's decision about availability for employment?
Availability, I think that's more of a legal argument. I think that the facts here are not really in question, for both, honestly. The facts are not in question. It's just a matter of applying the statute to the facts at issue, whether or not it's sufficient to meet the definition of a discharge, and whether or not the facts are sufficient to say that Mr. Modine was available for suitable employment.
We do have some case law that suggests whether it was a quit or not a quit, that that's a fact question. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that statement. Turning to the timeline at hand, Mr. Modine worked for Maribel for 7 years as a level A welder on the second shift. He worked Monday through Thursday in 10-hour shifts, earning $25.26 an hour.
Now, we've briefed all the facts. You can expound on the facts if you'd like, but because of your limited time, you might want to go right at the heart of your arguments.
Sure, Your Honor. The reason that I want to focus on this timeline is because when it comes to the point of discharge, there's a question about whether Mr. Modine resigned on November 13th or whether he was discharged on November 17th. If you view these facts in contractual terms, I would submit to the court that the only way that these facts can be read is that Mr. Modine was discharged on November 17th. On November 1st...
So don't come back tomorrow.
That's right. On November 1st, Maribel made an offer to Mr. Modine, telling him he could continue working on the second shift in a different non-welder position, or he could switch to the first shift and work as a welder. On November 13th, Mr. Modine rejected this offer and made a counteroffer. He said, I will continue working in the second shift until the end of the year, and up until December 31st, 2017. On November 15th, Jim Kendall, his supervisor, accepted this offer, and the testimony of Shelley Paulsrud corroborates this. On November 17th, however, Maribel had, quote, a change of heart, and called Mr. Modine to tell them, attempted to revoke this acceptance, and told him not to return to work on Monday. The decision of the unemployment law judge that Mr. Modine quit on November 13th should be reversed for three reasons. First, a notice of a future quit is not a quit at the time the notice is given. This comes from the statute, section 268.95, subdivision 2A. So at best, on November 13th, Mr. Modine submitted his resignation. Under subdivision 5D of the same statute, an employee who gives notice of intention to quit but is not allowed to work the entire notice period is discharged from the employment as of the date the employer will no longer allow the employee to work. So regardless of whether or not you view this as Mr. Modine submitting his resignation on November 13th, or you view this as the parties agreeing on November 15th to a new contractual employment term, Mr. Modine was discharged. Moving on to the second issue that I'd like to discuss today, whether or not Mr. Modine was available for and actively seeking suitable employment. The unemployment law judge found that Mr. Modine is not available for work more than a 20-minute drive from his home or for work on weekends. But the facts that are established throughout the transcript and in the record belie this conclusion. In fact, on the June 13th telephonic hearing, Mr. Modine listed a number of jobs to which he had applied, many of which were further than a 20-minute drive from his house. And Mr. Modine communicated that he would accept employment if he had found it. Unfortunately, Mr. Modine was not offered any position by any of the employers that he applied to, so he did not turn down any jobs, and he did not limit his job search. The question for this court, then, is where an employee expresses a preference to work closer to their home, but does not actually limit their job search in any way, does not actually decline employment in any way, whether or not that employee is available for work. I would submit that in this case, Mr. Modine was available for suitable employment. The case Work Connection v. Buie, I think, expresses what the unemployment law judge should have considered when making this decision. In that case, the court says that whether an applicant has good cause for rejecting potential suitable employment is a different standard than whether the applicant is available for suitable employment. In footnote 2, the court says the availability requirement merely demands that applicants who have lost their employment remain genuine in their willingness to accept new and suitable employment. It provides the lowest statutory bar. I submit that Mr. Modine has passed this very low threshold. The only evidence in the record relevant to whether Mr. Modine was available for suitable employment is whether or not he has applied without restrictions to jobs, he has, and whether or not he has turned down suitable employment because of those restrictions, he has not. If the court disagrees that Mr. Modine was not discharged by Maribel, there are two exceptions at play. First, whether Mr. Modine quit for a good reason caused by his employer, and second, whether he quit to provide necessary care for his wife, Kathy. Under the first exception, a good reason must be directly related to the employment, it must be adverse to the worker, it must compel an average, reasonable worker to quit, and in certain cases, the employee must inform the employer. Taken alone, all of the changes to Mr. Modine's employment may not have been sufficient alone for this exception to apply.
That is the salary reduction. That's one item, is that it? And another item is 5 days instead of 4 days. And what's, there's another item.
That's there? Right. So there's a 65-cent differential in the pay. There is a difference in the shift hour. So instead of working the second shift, which is 2:30 p.m. to 1 a.m., the morning shift is 6 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. These come with differences in hours and days. The night shift is 4 days, 10 hours. The day shift is 5 days, 8 hours. And then on top of this, there is the commute also that would apply. Alone, as I said, each of these changes may not have been enough to constitute a good reason caused by the employer. But together, the changes in wages and hours constitute circumstances that would compel a reasonable employee to quit his job.
I want to press you on that a little bit. So the additional commute, you say, would have been so onerous that we ought to consider it as a basis for good cause to quit.
I think it's a factor. Mr. Modine does not contest that factor is not caused by the employer, but I think the court can evaluate all of these changes together, whether or not it bears on the employer.
I'm just curious how that dovetails with your other argument that he wasn't intending to impose any restrictions, only a preference as to the commute. But now you're saying on this other issue that the commute is so onerous that a reasonable employee would have to quit. Help me to explain how the argument fits.
Your Honor, this is an argument in the alternative. I don't think that this is the strongest argument, which is why I'd like to rely on the argument that Mr. Modine was discharged from employment. But in the case that you find that Mr. Modine did in fact quit, I believe that this exception applies.
Tell me about the commute. What's the commute difference? Time of day?
The commute would be time of day and then also factoring in the morning traffic.
Okay. So the distance is the same. It's not a different location.
That's correct. Moving.
What you're saying on this third argument is if you take the wage loss, 65 cents an hour, 4 days, 5 days instead of 4 days, and the commute issues because of the extra days and the time of day, was that it? Was there another factor?
I believe those are the primary.
If you put those
factors
together, one of them, each one by himself would not be sufficient, but if you put those together, that that provides good cause by the employer.
Yes, I believe so. And the unemployment law judge never actually evaluated them in conjunction, which I think was an error. Moving on to the second exception, the statute provides two different medical exceptions. The first is if the applicant's own illness makes it medically necessary that the applicant quit. And the second is whether the applicant quit in order to provide necessary care because of the illness of an immediate family member. The unemployment law judge found that it was, quote, not medically necessary for Mr. Modine to quit his employment. I think here the unemployment law judge applied the wrong half of the statute. The question is not whether it was medically necessary for Mr. Modine to quit, but whether he needed to provide necessary care to his wife who has multiple sclerosis.
So you're saying the first part of the statute would apply to him, second part applies to a family member?
I think that's correct. And I think under the facts of this case, it's not disputed that Ms. Modine's condition is severe, that multiple sclerosis is a serious condition. And I think the unemployment law judge erred in failing to consider that.
There's been some discussion in the briefs about you have to request accommodation if you have those kind of issues.
Your Honor, Mr. Modine did not, at the time that Maribel came to him on November 1st, he did not raise the issue of his wife's medical condition because, as he states in the transcript, he believed that Maribel was aware of his wife's condition. But I believe Mattson supports the idea that the employee need not raise the issue at the exact moment, just that they need to discuss this with the employer and the employer needs to be aware. So I do not believe it was the fact.
So the issue is the employer needs to be aware, but does not have to be. There need not be a request for some accommodation. I thought there was a discussion in briefs that we had some case law that indicated there you have to give the employer an opportunity to accommodate these issues.
I do think there needs to be an opportunity for accommodation. I just don't think it needs to be contemporaneous with the termination discussion. In conclusion, I believe
that... I had a question about that. I wondered about what kind of accommodation the employer could make in this situation in any event. I mean, her condition is her condition, and if the employer didn't want to run a welding shift on the late shift, the night shift, for him to stay on as a welder with that kind of salary, it wouldn't be hard to imagine what kind of accommodation could even be possible.
Well, I'm not sure the statute requires that an accommodation is possible, just that the employer be given a chance to make an accommodation.
So he couldn't make an accommodation if the employer wanted to?
Yes. Unless there are further questions, I will conclude by saying the court should reverse decision 7822 on any one of the three independent grounds, and the court should reverse decision 1782 on the grounds that Mr. Modine was, in fact, available for suitable employment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Froelich, and I represent the respondent, the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. We ask that you affirm the decision of the unemployment law judge as it is legally correct.
Can I jump you right into the biggest problem I have with the analysis?
Go ahead.
So the unemployment law judge says that Mr. Modine testified that he wanted to be able to run home quickly. And then the finding is that he would prefer not to work on weekends. And then from that premise, the ULJ says Modine is placing restrictions on his availability. Those don't look like restrictions. They look like, from the ULJ's own words, preferences. Is a preference a restriction?
I think that's a fact question to determine if somebody prefers a job such that they would reject a job that's 40 miles away, which in fact in this case Mr. Modine did. He rejected the first shift job at Maribel, and he said he could not do that because of the care for his wife, and then goes on to say that he could do a first shift job if it was within 20 miles. And so in this case, the evidence does support that Mr. Modine has placed a restriction, which he has expressed as a preference to work within 20 miles of his home.
As a matter of law, have you found any other cases where a preference is treated as a restriction?
If something's purely a preference, if I want a job that pays $25 an hour, but I would accept a job that pays 20.
Well, you said it's a matter of fact, but the ULJ described the fact as a preference, not as a restriction, but then made a...
But she did go...
I'm
sorry.
A restriction.
She did go on to say in the reasons for decision that he is restricting himself to jobs that are within 20 miles of his home. And he does...
I don't know I understand that, because he was working at night, and the same miles are involved there, so I'm not...
I guess he was working 40 miles away at second shift at Maribel.
Yeah. So how is that? And he was willing to continue to work that shift.
Second shift.
Yeah, at that location, right?
Right.
Same miles?
Right.
So how is that making himself unavailable?
The law specifically states that to be available for suitable employment, you have to be available for daytime work if that's reasonable for your occupation. And so Mr. Modine needs to be available for daytime shift in order to be available. That's within the statute. Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Modine appears to have a distinction between the geographic location that he's willing to work during the day and what he's willing to work at a second shift.
One item in his thinking. The other item was his salary. The other item was the time of day. The other item was the hours per week. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to understand how one of those preferences or one of those concerns equals unavailability.
Because he limited the geographic area he was willing to work a daytime shift.
He didn't.
He did.
He wasn't willing to work the first shift for a number of reasons, only one of which was your item.
No, 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 other jobs. He told the ULJ that he was only willing to work a first shift job if it was within 20 miles of his home, when he was speaking generally about the jobs he was looking for.
The job that he had or the job that was offered to him.
Yes, but I would argue the reason he didn't take the first shift job at Maribel, Mr. Modine never says it's because of the shift differential. That didn't come up until counsel's brief to this court. He only said, the ULJ finds as a fact that he quit because of the commute and the change in hours, not because of the shift differential, because of the loss of that.
So the shift differential never came up before the referee?
He did mention the shift differential. He did not mention it as a reason that he didn't take the job. And the words he uses to describe the shift differential are very minimal. When the ULJ, for instance, asked him about the change in pay if he went to first shift, he says it's just the loss of the shift differential. He never mentions that it's significant or that was a reason that he didn't want the job. He tells the employer he didn't want the job because of the commute, because the commute would create a hardship. He never mentions the shift differential. He never mentions the care for his wife.
So, counsel, I'd like to ask you about your position on availability. You tied it somewhat to the statutory reference to daytime shift availability. So does the statute clearly say what is a daytime shift?
It does not. It does not give hours.
It's interesting. Obviously, shifts get defined different ways by different employers.
Yes.
The second shift here started at 2:30 p.m., which most of us still consider to be the daytime. It does go late, you know, until 1 a.m. So when does the first shift start?
6 or 6:30
okay.
at Maribel.
So you're just assuming that because in this particular case, the first shift would be somehow the meaning of daytime shift in the statute, but that's not necessarily the case.
Yes, and I would argue that within daytime shift, it says that's reasonable for an industry. And since he's working as a welder, it's certainly reasonable for a welder to be available for a shift that starts before 2:30. And since he's not making himself available for shifts that start earlier than that, when they're more than 20 miles away, that's how we get to the conclusion that he's not available for suitable employment.
On the quit, I'd like you to discuss the purpose of advising an employee not to come to work if the employee has already quit.
So a discharge is defined as a statute as words or actions that would lead a reasonable person to believe that the employer will no longer allow them to work in any capacity. Mr. Modine always knew that there was continuing work available to him. He says on the 19th page of the transcript that he knew he could go to first shift or take a second shift job at a reduced rate. And on the 80th page, the judge explicitly asks him if he knew there was continuing work available to him, and he says that he does. So
notwithstanding that, his employer tells him not to come back. Is it on the 17th?
Not to come back to second shift.
Is that the language? Not come back to second shift or don't come back tomorrow?
It's unclear precisely what the language is that he says, but it's undisputed that the employer did tell him in some way that he shouldn't return to work. However, at any point, the unemployment law judge made a finding of fact that says continuing work was available to Mr. Modine. And there is evidence in the record to support that finding of fact because Mr. Modine concedes that there was continuing work or that there was additional work available to him. The evidence supports that at that point when Mr. Modine was told he couldn't come back to work, that was to second shift and that he still could have made that choice that he could go to first shift if he wanted that option.
So these are all the things that he had to assume that wasn't precisely indicated to him, however, is that right?
There's no evidence about what exactly was said to him at that point.
Well,
that's correct. There's
evidence that he had taken 2 days vacation and his employer wasn't happy about that. And so at the end of that...
That's his testimony.
As I said, there's some evidence.
Yes. Yes.
The trial court didn't make a finding that wasn't true, did it?
No. Okay. They didn't make... I don't believe... I believe they did make findings that there were vacation. I don't believe they made findings regarding the employer's perspective on that.
But the finding that, I'm just going to quote here from the ULJ, mm-hmm. The finding, quote, that he should not come to work, period. If that is an accurate description of the communication, I'm at a loss for how an employee would assume that means don't come to work on this shift, but come to some other shift.
I don't think you have to assume here, because we have Mr. Modine's own testimony that he knew continuing work was available to him. And if he did know continuing work was available to him on the first shift...
The company hadn't offered him first shift today or tomorrow. Wasn't there a future time when this was all to occur?
So when the company on November 1st told him that they were going to end the second shift position, they told him that he would have to make the choice by November 16th.
When was the effective date of a change supposed to be?
It's unclear exactly what the effective date is. I know he had to say...
The record isn't clear that he could come back the 17th in the first shift.
Except that Mr. Modine testified that he knew continuing work was available to him.
Available, but that doesn't mean that the employer is going to let him work for a shift the next day, does it?
But per his testimony, he said he knew he could go back to work on first shift.
He knew he could go to work on the 17th?
He says on the 19th page of the transcript that he knew he could go to work on the fifth shift. I don't know if he knew the precise date.
I'm sorry, the fifth shift?
He knew he could go to work on the first shift.
Well, but that's the point.
Or?
He was told, don't come back tomorrow. So if he had come back the next day, would he have had a job?
The finding of fact that the ULJ made.
The record reflect, and the ULJ said he would be able to work the first shift the next day?
She did not make that specific a finding. It just says continuing work was available.
Yeah. I don't know that is all that probative on whether or not he could have come back the next day and what the employer meant when he said don't come back tomorrow.
Yes, the record is...
Don't come back tomorrow to work the second shift. Don't come back tomorrow because we don't want you here anymore. Don't come back tomorrow, but unless you want to come back to the first shift, that wasn't described to him. So it's a little ambiguous what exactly was meant, is it not?
The record is less than straightforward on exactly what happened after that conversation. However, I would go back to what you said earlier. The standard is whether there's substantial evidence in the record to support the findings of fact of the ULJ. And in the timeline of events, she mentions that they did tell the Mr. Modine not to return to work, and the next sentence in her decision is that continuing work was available. So when you read her decision, I think you can reasonably interpret it to mean that there was work available after that conversation.
The record reflect that he could have worked at that company first shift the next day.
I believe it was a Friday to Monday, but ignoring that for a moment, I don't think the record is specific as to exactly when he could go back. What I would go back to is Mr. Modine's testimony that he knew he could do second shift or first shift.
Don't come back tomorrow, or was it don't come back next Monday?
That's unclear.
I thought there was some testimony that don't come back tomorrow. Am I wrong about that?
I don't recall anything saying tomorrow.
Okay.
That's not my...
Well, what is your recollection of the record on that this item? Don't come back when? Don't come back Monday? Don't come back tomorrow?
My reading of it was the 17th to the 20th, the Friday to the Monday. But I...
Do you have the transcript?
I do have the transcript.
I don't mean to have you eat up your time. If you can just at some point let us know what the transcript is on that.
I apologize. The part that I flipped to is where on page 40,
sure.
They said the company's had a change of heart. We do not want you to work throughout the rest of the year, which is not helpful to my position.
So the company had a change of heart.
Those are the words that are used, yep. So Would I?
Change, and what would be the reasonable inference? A change from what to what?
A change of heart in allowing him to continue working second shift for longer than they had originally anticipated. He was originally going, they were going to allow him to work second shift for 2 more weeks, or he had to make the decision to go to first shift by November 16th. And then they agreed to let him work second shift for approximately 2 months until mid-January. And then they had a change of heart to go back to requiring him to work first shift if he was going to continue employment.
You need to quit now because we won't let you work the other 2 months that we said we'd let you work.
Or you can work first shift.
Yeah. Well, 2 months would have been some time for some other things that could have happened as well. I don't know. It looks to me like we don't want you, period. We've had a change of heart.
They said that they were not intending to discharge him. That was not the intention, and they wanted him to continue working first shift.
But after he takes the vacation and after they come to the agreement, your language is the company has a change of heart.
About allowing him to work second shift.
Is that what the language is? Or we just have a change of heart? You just read it to me a minute ago.
Let me pull it up again. I apologize. You're right. The language doesn't specify the shift. And I think the record is at least unclear as to what precisely was happening at that time. But I would go back to there is evidence in the record supporting the ULJ's conclusion that continuing work was available. With that, thank you.
Thank you. Now, we don't ordinarily, in fact, we don't ever allow surrebuttal, but Judge Klopaki asked you a specific question about the record. So if during the relator's argument you come across something more specific in the record that responds to the question, we'll give you an opportunity to offer it.
Thank you.
Counsel for relator.
Thank you, Your Honors. Tavita McGee once again. I'd like to turn back to the issue of quit and hopefully address your questions, Your Honor. In the record is the termination letter that was given to Mr. Modine on November 1st. That letter states, effective November 17th, there will no longer be a position on second shift available. Further down in the letter, it says that he will need to notify Shelley Paulsrud of your decision before Thursday, November 16th. So again, Mr. Modine does not work on Friday, November 17th. He would need to notify Maribel on Thursday, November 16th. In the transcript, at page 40, Shelley Paulsrud testifies about the interactions. She says, on November 13th, he, Mr. Modine, came into my office and he gave me the letter of him declining the opportunity to move to first shift. He had mentioned that he would be willing to work throughout the first of the year. Initially, we thought, hey, that's a great idea. So Jim had originally told him, yeah, that would be great. But then when Jim went and talked to him those days, he was here cleaning out his toolbox later on. So that gave us the sour note. And that's when we decided we had the change of heart. Jim called him back, I believe, on that Friday the 17th, the day after he would have had to give his notice, again, a day that he did not work, the Friday, and said, the company's had a change of heart. We do not want you to work throughout the rest of the year. Thank you for the option, but we're declining. I think the record here is clear. Mr. Modine and Maribel had come to an agreement that he could work throughout the end of the year. He was discharged on November 17th when Maribel called him on a day after the initial letter had expired, on a day that he did not work, to tell him not to return to work. Turning to the issue of availability, I do not believe Mr. Modine placed any restrictions on his work. And there is a difference in the standard of review applied to Mr. Modine's decision not to, whether or not he quit for a good reason caused by the employer, and whether or not he was available for suitable employment. So I do not think we can compare the decision that Mr. Modine was making with respect to the commute that he had to make and the other factors, because the standard of review is different. The shift differential has come up before, and it is clear in the testimony that this was something that Mr. Modine had brought up from the beginning. Again, Shelley Paulsrud's testimony on page 38 of the transcript, Don mentioned in that meeting that he was willing to do anything other than welding in the company. Later on, he at that time said he had no interest.
There wasn't.
He was.
He was willing to work.
He was. But later it says he at that time said he had no interest in a cut in pay. So I think from the beginning, he made it clear to his employer that he was not, that the shift differential was in fact important to him, and that he would be willing to do other things if he could continue making the same salary. That wasn't possible because it's union jobs and they all have certain salaries. And then I'd also like to point out in the record that there is testimony showing that Mr. Modine has worked the second shift over the course of his career, not just at Maribel, but I believe it's the past 20 years at different companies. So while it is reasonable for welders to be available during the day, it also is just as reasonable for those positions to be available in a second shift type of situation that starts later in the afternoon.
Apparently, the reason they didn't want him there in the second shift is that they weren't willing to provide or didn't have available engineering or other folks who would give him some directions on the prints for the second shift. Is that right?
And they could have clearly terminated him if they didn't want him to work the second shift. But I think their reasons for terminating that position are not relevant to the inquiry here. Unless there are further questions, I will rest. Thank you very much.
There appear to be none. Ms. Froelich, did you come across any specific references in the transcript to respond to Judge Klobuchar's question?
Not the transcript, but on Exhibit 5, page 9 of, these are Mr. Modine's notes. It says, Jim called, and he labels it as on November 17th. Jim called in the afternoon and said the company had a change of heart and they didn't want me to come back to work on November 20th. So that's what.
Monday.
That's Monday, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to both counsel. Well argued. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.